This is Functional Medicine Update for February 2004, Volume 24, Number 2. Our subject for this month is women's health. We will include a report on pharmacogenetic uniqueness, the new recognition of functional medicine in current literature, the measurement of patients' functional status, hormonal balance in menopause, variation of response to hormonal management, breast health and the HRT study, and fibromyalgia. We will complete this issue with our guest interview of Dr. Alan Warshawski, discussing his insight and experience in the practice of obstetrics and gynecology. Now, here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland and the February 2004 edition of Functional Medicine Update.
Welcome to Functional Medicine Update for February 2004. This issue we're going to focus on one of the aspects that will be covered in our 11th International Symposium on Functional Medicine entitled The Coming Pandemic, Type 2 Diabetes. And as you know, we've been trying to frame this question around insulin resistance and hyperinsulinemia beyond that just of diabetes itself. And so this issue we're going to look at the effect on estrogen hormones and natural management of estrogen imbalances and its interrelationship with the insulin signaling pathway and the peroxisome proliferated activated receptors and some of the other effects that has been on progesterone, estrogen, testosterone, and their metabolism. Before we move into that, however, I'd like to share with you an interesting article that just appeared, which I think illustrates the kind of controversy that's swirling in the world at large as it relates to the best mechanism by which to intervene in patients who have complex chronic age-related diseases. This is actually a recent article that describes a presentation made by a senior researcher, vice president actually, at GlaxoSmithKline, who was talking about the efficacy of pharmaceutical drugs for the management of these chronic health conditions. In this particular presentation, he wanted to say, and I think it surprised everybody at the conference, that most prescription medications do not work on most people who take them. Dr. Alan Roses, who is the vice president of genetics for GlaxoSmithKline, said fewer than half of patients prescribed some of the most expensive drugs actually derive any benefit from them. He went on to say that most of the products are ineffective in patients, but this is the first time that a mechanism has been actually ascribed to why this is the case that ties itself back to the area of pharmacogenomics, the unique differences from person to person in how they metabolize and respond to specific substances. Dr. Roses, by the way, was an academic geneticist at Duke University Medical School for many years before he joined in the consultancy at GlaxoSmithKline as their vice president. He went on to say that drugs for Alzheimer's disease work in fewer than 1 in 3 patients, whereas those that are for cancer are only effective in 25% of patients. Drugs for migraine, for osteoporosis, and arthritis work in only about 50% the patients. Most drugs work in fewer than 1 in 2 patients, mainly because the recipients carry genes that interfere in some way with the medicine, he went on to say. And I quote, the vast majority of drugs, more than 90%, only work in 30% to 50% of people, end quote. A following quote, you know, he said, I wouldn't say that most drugs don't work. I would say that most drugs work in 30% to 50% of people. Drugs out there on the market work, but they don't work in everybody, end quote. Doctors often think that when a drug is approved that it's going to influence all of their patients in similar ways. So I think that there's a really interesting outcome from this. In fact, the article goes on to say that this goes against the marketing culture within the pharmaceutical industry that has relied on selling as many drugs as possible to the widest number of patients, this kind of megabuster type of drug, and that this megabuster blockbuster leads to a culture that is then been able to take one drug and sell it to lots of people, assuming that anyone with that diagnosis is going to get a specific kind of response. Now with pharmacogenomics, we're recognizing that the response may be highly varied from one individual to the other based upon their pharmacogenomic uniqueness. This also relates in part to the theme that we're going to be talking about this month, which is the modification of hormonal balance in women as part of the endocrine web, the symphonic orchestration of the messenger molecules that control cellular tissue organ function. And recently, the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists developed some medical guidelines for the clinical use of dietary supplements and nutraceuticals in the modulation of these endocrinological complexities. I found that this paper, which was published in Endocrine Practice, Volume 9, page 417 in 2003. By the way, this is a fairly lengthy review paper. It has 550 references attached to it, and it's over 50 pages in length. In this particular publication, this review about the use of nutraceuticals in endocrine practice, they go on to talk about alternative medicine, and they talk about the definition of alternative care. But then they go on to say that the problem with alternative medicine often is the therapies are offered without explanation of mechanism. In point 5 of this document, it goes on to talk about functional medicine approach to endocrine and metabolic disorders. And I quote, it goes on to say, physicians should remain abreast of not only advances in traditional medicine, but also evolving alternative medical practices. Sorting out through the seemingly endless lexicon that is articulated by alternative care practitioners is particularly challenging. Nonetheless, analysis of alternative options may yield advantages. First, such studies can be informative and lead to lateral thinking and innovative applications of proven therapy. Second, they can stimulate new ideas for the design of scientific medical research. And third, they can assist discussions with patients contemplating such therapies. One alternative practice that is gaining popularity is, quote, functional medicine. This term is used by health practitioners to describe a clinical approach emphasizing, one, the physiologic and biochemical uniqueness of each patient, two, the ability of laboratory testing to detect such uniqueness, and three, the importance of minor symptoms to guide prevention of and therapy for suboptimal health, degenerative disease, and chronic illness. The overarching teleologic principle in functional medicine is that the individualized nutrition based on a person's unique genotype and phenotype can produce a state of improved health. Functional medicine then uses functional foods, and these are defined as foods that contain inadequate concentration substances that have a positive effect upon physiological function. In functional medicine, complex theories involving the psycho-immuno-neuroendocrine axis are blueprints for natural interventions. Data from scientific studies are applied to buttress an argument against polypharmacy with traditional medicines and to favor lifestyle changes and the use of a wide variety of dietary supplements and nutraceuticals. Nutrigenomic and nutriproteomic therapies are nutritional interventions directed at genomic and cellular mechanisms of disease. An example would be the genomic screening of children early in life, perhaps in utero, for methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase polymorphisms related to folic acid. A potential treatment then would be to increase the dietary intake of folate or the nutraceutical 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate. This approach would theoretically then help prevent pediatric leukemia, which has been linked to altered folate metabolism. So I think it's very exciting to see that the functional medicine model is at least on the radar screen and being described in clinical guidelines that appear in various forms of specialty medicine. And this month, we're obviously going to be speaking about the specialty medicines of endocrinology and obstetrics gynecology and the role that lifestyle and diet and environmental modulation can play in those disciplines. We're really measuring then functional status, because a lot of the conditions that we're going to be discussing this month, which include things like fibrocystic disease of the breast, cervical dysplasia, uterine fibroids, preclinical polycystic ovary syndrome, perimenopause, and PMS, premenstrual syndrome, would not be considered diseases as such, but rather conditions. We might call them functional physiological disturbances, endocrinological imbalances. And we're going to hear from our clinician of the month, Dr. Alan Ruchowski, this month about an approach that he's been using, utilizing a functional medicine model for the management of these complex endocrinological symptom clusters. So we're really talking about how to measure functional status. And I was very intrigued to see in the recent issue of the journal Arthritis and Rheumatism, which is the journal of the American College of Rheumatology, a series of papers discussing measures of adult general function, functional status measures. And when I went through this particular fairly lengthy publication, it was interesting to see how many different ways of assessing function, from psychological function, somatic function, physical functioning, cognitive and mental functioning, to physiologic functions. We are certainly all aware of the health appraisal questionnaire, the SF short form MOS medical outcome survey questionnaire. All of these are used for evaluating quality of life issues and various types of disabilities from a functional level that then track back or map back against various kinds of physiological and physical dysfunctions that may be prior to the onset of a very cleanly defined disease. In other words, something that fits into the domain very nicely of an ICD-9 code. So well before that, there can be functional decrements. And this article that appeared in volume 49, page 15 in 2003 in Arthritis and Rheumatism talks about measures of adult general functional status, the Barthel Index, the CATS Index of Activities of Daily Living, the Health Assessment Questionnaire, the MACTAR, M-A-C-T-A-R, Patient Preference Disability Questionnaire, and the Modified Health Assessment Questionnaire, as well as the Medical Outcome Survey, short form 36, all of which measure aspects of functional capability in the absence of a clean diagnosis. There is then a second review paper that followed this entitled Measures of Adult General Performance Tasks. This is ways of actually getting physical types of measurements in office for evaluating functional status. And these include things like the Berg Balance Scale for measuring equilibrium and proprioceptor activity, the Dynamic Gait Index, the Gait Velocity, the Physical Performance Test, the Time Chair Stand Test, the Tinetti Performance-Oriented Mobility Assessment. These are ways of evaluating on a gross level certain aspects that have to do with the peripheral and central nervous system activity, the immunological system, the structural balance of the patient, and how they track back against physiological and physical functioning. Now, why am I going into that? Because it is these early warning evaluative tools that then see themselves in terms of symptoms and signs in patients that present with different severity, intensity, and duration that then often become the indicators of what will be later stage more serious problems. For instance, we now know that patients who start to lose smell acuity and taste acuity are often at higher risk than to later stage Alzheimer's disease. This may be an early warning functional assessment test then, is loss of the sense of taste and loss of the sense of smell. So when we start examining these markers, it leads to a different set of questions than what is the diagnosis. It really relates to what is the physical, physiological, cognitive, and mental functioning. Now, hormonal imbalances are obviously a good example of things that track early on in terms of changed symptoms in the absence of diagnosis. And menopause, of course, is one good example of that, particularly perimenopause, where there is this very significant change in hormone levels from period to period. It's not that women just suffer from low estrogen, and therefore they have the flushing, the night sweats, the cognitive disturbances, the sleep disturbances, the depression, dysphoria, because of low estrogen. It's the rapid changing levels of estrogen in perimenopause from very high to low, and the metabolism of those intermediaries that trigger many of the symptoms that are associated with menopause, and the imbalance of one form of an androgen estrogen to another form, a progesterone insufficiency relative to a estrogen excess in the moment. These are the kinds of things that then create the whipsaw effect on physiology that's seen as functional changes in outcome that questionnaires, as the type I was just describing, can pick up well before you have a clean diagnosis. And in fact, as you know, we should not view menopause as a disease. It's a condition. It's a normal transition that women at their fifth decade of life normally go through. It's the severity to which they are put that is the real concern, and the symptoms and signs that result as a consequence of these altering hormone values and how they influence physiological, cognitive, mental, and physical functioning. So is there a way of managing menopause naturally, asked the question. In fact, this was the article in Nutrition Today, volume 38, page 191 in 2003. And the answer is obviously, yes, you can manage menopause naturally because it's been done throughout most of human history. We didn't have the availability of exogenous hormone replacement, so women have been doing it for a long period of time. But the question really says, can we improve the transition by using various supplements like black cohosh or soy isoflavones or cruciferous vegetable glucosinolate concentrates or various other types of adrenal adaptogenic substances like licorice? Do these influence then the transition into menopause? Or can they lower the most common symptoms that women experience, which are disabling symptoms when they're severe and high frequency, like night sweats and hot flushing? A very interesting review was recently published in Alternative Medicine Review, Volume 8, page 284 in 2003, entitled Hot Flushes, a review of the literature on alternative and complementary treatment approaches. And in this particular nicely done review, it talks about the various medications that have traditionally been used for trying to modify hot flushes and night sweats, and then how those compare against natural interventions using natural selective estrogen response modulators that are in the form of isoflavones or lignans or removing gut dysbiosis and improving appropriate digestive function. A body is run by a foot on two pedals on both the accelerator and the brake simultaneously to balance out cellular function. So the right balance of 2-methoxyestradiol to 2-estradiol itself becomes an important part of modulating function. And we know that the cruciferous vegetables rich in glucosinolates help to increase 2-hydroxylation, and that the catechol-O-methyltransferase enzyme then transfers a methyl group from S-adenosylmethionine onto the 2-hydroxyestradiol to produce 2-methoxyestradiol and 2-methoxyestrone, which are the estrogen-breaking substances, anti-mitotic, anti-cellular proliferative, and tend to calm down the estrogen message of estradiol, which is cellular proliferative and increased DNA mitotic activity. So what we're seeing is the relationship of diet to function playing out in terms of signs and symptoms that the patient experiences. Then we ask the question, do all women respond identically to these interventions? And just as we said earlier that people respond differently to medications, so we should say that people respond differently to diet and lifestyle interventions. We are biochemically unique. This genetic polymorphism, this variation of SNPs in our human population, 2 to 3 million different single nucleotide polymorphisms in our genome of 30 to 35,000 genes, codes for many different variations on a theme. And so we know that estrogen can do things like modulate xanthine oxidase activity, but this is modulated by a receptor-dependent and a receptor-independent mechanism. So you might have relationships between estrogen and estrogen metabolism on vastly different physiological functions that are unique to the individuals. For instance, things like purine metabolism, xanthine oxidase, or oxidative stress, because as you know, the enzyme xanthine oxidase, when it's upregulated, produces superoxide. And superoxide in the presence of nitric oxide, when you have an immune-activated individual, that nitric oxide and superoxide can react very rapidly chemically to produce in the body peroxynitrite. Peroxynitrite is a very powerful irritating nitrosating reagent that injures proteins, and so now you get altered protein function. So what am I saying? An immune upregulated pro-inflammatory state coupled with altered estrogen metabolism can produce then an outcome called oxidative injury. So these are web-like effects. They're not just things that work in isolation. The symptom doesn't come from one factor. It's a variety of factors weaving themselves together. By the way, that discussion I just talked about, estrogen modulating xanthine oxidase activity and how that could interrelate to postmenopausal inflammation, is described in Antioxidants and Redox Signals, Volume 5, page 705 in 2003. And what it says is that estrogen goes down, the conversion of xanthine dehydrogenase to xanthine oxidase increases, and that xanthine oxidase then produces more superoxide. So this may be another component of postmenopausal lowering of estrogen, increasing the incidence of inflammatory conditions and oxidative stress in women. That might also tie together with a variety of oxidative-related and inflammatory-related disorders, like arthritis or like heart disease in postmenopausal women. And we know that these relationships are individualized to a woman's own genetic uniqueness, just as her response to drugs is, in fact, modified by her genetic uniqueness, so is her response to her environment and lifestyle and diet. This is a very interesting paper actually just recently published in the Journal of the American Medical Association entitled Association Between Estrogen Receptor Alpha Gene Variation and Cardiovascular Disease, showing that certain kinds of polymorphisms of the estrogen receptor have a much higher statistical correlation with cardiovascular disease, and that estrogen receptor variation has the potential to explain recent conflicting data regarding the effects of hormone therapy on cardiovascular disease susceptibility in women. There may be some women who carry these SNPs of the ER-alpha sensitivity who on hormone replacement therapy have a lowered risk to cardiovascular disease, whereas other women may have an elevated risk depending upon how that polymorphism of a receptor responds to an environment, i.e. the hormone. So again, individualization, customization, personalization of medicine is where we're going. And in fact, that was the title of an editorial that appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine on hormone therapy. Custom approaches to the woman, individualized therapy, not just one size fits all, you know, whatever the body mass of the person is, give them a dose responsive to their body mass, rather looking at their individual needs. And we know that the relationship of many of these nutritional agents is to modify as agonist/antagonist estrogen metabolism. What does that mean? That's like an adaptogenic effect. Highs go down and lows come up. And the agonist effect is low goes to high, and antagonist effect is high goes to low. It tends to normalize around a set point. This is what has traditionally been called an adaptogen. And in fact, that's what soy isoflavones in part do, is they serve as agonist/antagonist of estrogen metabolism, or adaptogens of estrogen response. In a recent paper that appeared in Medical Hypothesis, it was described that estrogen agonists and antagonists like soy isoflavones may downregulate growth hormone signaling and therefore have an influence on a whole variety of effects, including things like insulin sensitivity through IGF-1 and IGF-1 binding protein and impacts on lipoprotein A, which then may explain how estrogen can modulate cardiovascular risk and insulin sensitivity. It's a web. The endocrinological web is an interconnected series of signals that then create in cells and tissue specificity outcome called their function. And I think that this concept of functionality is more than just an idle cocktail banter. It has real play in understanding how to manage patients with complex chronic health problems that are related to the imbalance of these chemical messengers, of these signaling substances, like the sex steroid hormones. Now, what about breast cancer and hormone replacement therapy? We discussed recently the results of the Million Woman Study. As you probably recall, this is the largest study ever been done looking at the effect of hormone replacement therapy on breast cancer incidence, and indicated that, in fact, there was a statistically significant and meaningful increase in breast cancer risk and incidence, regardless of the type of estrogen used, be it estradiol or equine mixed conjugated estrogens, there was an increased risk. So all forms of estrogen, if imbalanced in their delivery and metabolism, may pose a risk when administered exogenously. Even endogenous estrogen, when it shows great excursions in the body and doesn't get properly metabolized and excreted, may pose a risk. And that's why the Institute of Medicine 2 years ago suggested that estrogen is a carcinogen. It seemed rather very unusual to think a natural substance in the body could be a carcinogen. But what we're really talking about is imbalanced estrogen, inappropriately metabolized estrogen, or elevated estrogen and or its metabolites could in fact pose a carcinogenic risk, and the Million Woman Study seemed to indicate that. It's also important to recall that estrogen can be manufactured in tissues that are outside the ovary. For instance, the breast and the adipocyte cells of particularly visceral adipose tissue will manufacture estrogen, and this estrogen can be converted into estrogen metabolites like the 4-hydroxyestrogens, which are these catechol estrogens that Dr. Rogan and others have told us about. They can be very caustic and cause DNA injury in DNA addicts that pose carcinogenic risk. We know that the breast itself can generate estrogen, and there is the isoform of cytochrome P450 in the breast that can convert that directly into the 4-hydroxyestrogens. This is cytochrome P450 1B1. Recent papers on the polymorphisms of cytochrome P450 1B1 and its relationship to postmenopausal breast cancer risk have indicated that there's a strong correlation between cytochrome P450 1B1 gene polymorphisms and how estrogen is metabolized, but there's no strong influence yet of risk to breast cancer because there may be other modifying factors as to how that plays out in the phenotype. In other words, yes, you may have a polymorphism cytochrome P450 1B1, but then secondary factors of how those catechol estrogens are metabolized by methoxylation or by glutathione conjugation may then render these potential 3,4-quinone estrogens detoxify before they can actually have an injurious effect upon DNA. So it's not just a single point gene mutation or a single SNP that creates an outcome in the phenotype called breast cancer. It's a pattern of genetic uniquenesses coupled with environmental selections and dietary exposures that then ultimately gives rise to the outcome. And so when we start talking about a functional medicine approach towards endocrinological outcome, It has to take into account this web of interacting variables and look at how hormones, say, influence insulin, insulin-like growth factor 1, insulin growth factor 1 binding protein, lipoprotein synthesis like apolipoprotein A1 or B1. All of these are part of the web of understanding of how that individual patient, that woman, is responding to her environment. By the way, this study I was just describing on cytochrome P450-1B1, which, as you know, is the specific isoform in the breast that manufactures the 4-hydroxyestrogens, and how that relates to postmenopausal breast cancer risk, was published in the journal Carcinogenesis, Volume 24, page 1533, in 2003. We also recognize that the conversion of these hydroxylated estrogens, like the 4-hydroxyestradiol, into the non-toxic byproducts involves methylation. Methylation, as I mentioned, is activated by catechol-O-methyltransferase, and it requires the presence of a methyl donor called S-adenosylmethionine, or SAM. Where does SAM come from? Proper activity of the folate cycle. Are there polymorphisms in the folate cycle that may then impair the ability of the body to produce at the site necessary proper levels of SAM? And the answer is yes. These are polymorphisms like the methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase C677T polymorphism that we were discussing earlier. Is there any relationship between a polymorphism of the methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase gene and folate and riboflavin status as it tracks into homocysteine and the methylation of homocysteine ultimately through that cycle to produce SAM? And the answer is yes. Journal of Nutrition, Volume 133, page 2716 in 2003, showed that combined marginal folate and riboflavin vitamin B2 status affects in the homocysteine methylation in people who have this homozygous MTHFR C677T mutation, meaning if you have that polymorphism, you cannot handle lower levels of riboflavin and folate as well as a person who doesn't have that SNP, and therefore you have impaired methylation, increasing your homocysteine, decreasing your methyl hormone levels, and that then can have a different dynamic on the web related to risk. We know that also from a study authored by Dr. Lynn Bailey entitled Folate Methyl-Related Nutrients, Alcohol, and MTHFR 677 C-T Polymorphism Affecting Breast Cancer Risk. And in this particular paper, goes on to say that alcohol causes increased turnover and loss of the B vitamins, including the riboflavin, pyridoxine, and folate, and if you have a MTHFR 677 C-T polymorphism, then that makes you already more folate-dependent. Now you increase your alcohol intake, that lowers your folate status and your sufficiency of the folate cycle, that lowers your SAM levels, and that influences then relative cancer risk when exposed to the same level of carcinogens that someone else who has proper folate chemistry would not have risk to. And so now, again, we can't say a single exposure to a carcinogen is a risk. We can't say a single consumption of alcohol is a risk. We can't say a single dietary insufficiency of B6, B12, folate, and B2 is a risk. Or can we say just in isolation a polymorphism of MTHFR is a risk? But you put them all together. You start having the person consuming alcohol frequently, a person who doesn't eat very well, a person under high stress, a person who has the polymorphism, and a person then who really is exposed to xenoestrogens in their environment that increase then the hydroxylation to the 4 family, or maybe is taking mixed conjugated equine estrogens, which is known to increase the 4 hydroxylation. All of those together eventually paints a picture of higher risk. This is, again, Journal of Nutrition, Volume 133, page 3748 in 2003. Now, is there any difference in bioavailability of folic acid versus the natural 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate, or 5-MTHF? That's the principal form of folic acid that is found within cells, is the 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate. That's the form of folic acid that's on the other side of the enzyme step that's mediated by methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase, or MTHFR. So if a person had an MTHFR polymorphism, homozygous 677CT polymorphism, the ability to convert methylene tetrahydrofolate to 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate would be reduced. Then the question is, does that have anything to do with the clinical outcome and their ability to produce SAM, S-adenosylmethionine, at marginal intakes of folate, B12, B6, and riboflavin? And in this particular paper that was recently published again in the Journal of Nutrition, Volume 133, page 3678 in 2003, They looked at, in this case, yogurt fortified with either 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate or folic acid, given in the same quantities, molar quantities, and they found that the accessibility with 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate, meaning its gastrointestinal absorption, was significantly greater than that of folic acid itself. So it appears that A, food delivery forms can provide folic acid in absorbable forms, B, that there are certain kinds of folic acid derivatives that may appear more bioavailable than others, and three, that if you deliver an absorbable form of a folic derivative that's on the other side of enzyme blocks, like the methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase enzyme block as a consequence of a SNP, that you are more likely then to increase the activity of that folate form in helping to support the formation of S-adenosylmethionine. So one starts to look at dietary uniqueness based upon an individual's own metabolic patterns that are locked into their genome as to whether they carry some of these SNPs, which would then be enhanced in their function if you are on the other side of that metabolic block with the form of the vitamin, in this case 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate. We also know that individuals respond differently to dietary phytoestrogens based upon their own individual metabolism and activity. These would be things like the soy isoflavones, such as digoxine and genistein. We also recognize that when a person responds to these isoflavones, that the response has principally been found through estrogen receptor beta rather than estrogen receptor alpha. Now, this is interesting because estrogen receptor beta are very high in number in bone, in the osteoclastic cell and the osteoblastic cell, as contrasted to estrogen receptor alpha, which are very high, for instance, in the ovary or the breast. So if you preferentially then activate or modulate the response of estrogen receptor beta, you're having a significant effect on bone dynamics. This would be like the SERM, raloxifen, to use an analogy from the pharmaceutical industry in which a substance is working more on bone than breast. In this particular case, looking at dietary phytoestrogens and their effect on bone, this is actually a very nice review paper that appeared in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, volume 78, page 593 in 2003. They did a kind of a meta-analysis of 24 different studies, 17 in vitro studies, 24 in vivo studies on the animal models of postmenopausal osteoporosis, and 15 human observational epidemiological studies, and 17 dietary intervention studies looking at the role of isoflavones on bone dynamics, bone cell physiology, or on bone loss in women. On balance, they go on to say that the collective data suggests that diets that are rich in these soy isoflavones, so-called phytoestrogens, have bone-sparing effects in the long term. And there is now evidence would suggest that the effects, when coupled with weight-bearing exercise, as simple as a regular walking program, may have as beneficial effects on retention of bone and prevention of fracture risk as that of the SERMs, so without some of the adverse risk of side effects from the synthetic molecules. So this is an evolving story, but again, I just wanted to indicate that sometimes people would say, well, you know, you're going to have to use hormone replacement therapy of some type, either selective estrogen response modifiers or modulators or estrogen itself, because you can't get all the benefits that you can get from these hormone modulators, say, from natural substances. And it appears as if the story is evolving to say no. If a woman exercises, if she is in lower stress, if she's eating a high-quality diet, if she's making sure she's getting adequate levels of calcium, magnesium, vitamin D, vitamin K, and she's getting adequate levels of these isoflavones, which modulate estrogen receptivity and activity and estrogen metabolism, that lo and behold, the outcome can be very positive. So you have the vitamin K, and you have the vitamin D, and you have the methylation story, and you have the calcium story, and you have the soy isoflavone story. This is framing a pattern of intervention, not a single agent. It's not a magic bullet, but rather it's a complex intervention using a diet and lifestyle that is consistent with what women did in cultures that didn't have access to these pharmaceuticals, but seemed to have, once they got through infectious diseases and childbearing, their transition to menopause in their older age was quite good. So that leads us into then looking at a whole series of effects that occur as a consequence of imbalances of hormones. And one of those conditions that I find fascinating that we have discussed in previous issues of Functional Medicine Update in 2003 is fibromyalgia. You know, fibromyalgia might be seen as a complex condition that is an outcome from an imbalance of the neuroendocrine immune system. The Arthritis and Rheumatism Journal recently, volume 49, page 210 in 2003, talked about the fibromyalgia impact questionnaire. And if you look at the questionnaire used to evaluate fibromyalgia with trigger points and tender points and certain disabilities, they tie back again to what appear to be immunological and neuroendocrine imbalances. The subgrouping of fibromyalgia patients on the basis of pressure pain thresholds indicates that fibromyalgia may be a heterogeneous disorder, not a single disease, but a heterogeneous disorder with different variegated forms that lead to these myalgic pains and the fatigue and the sleep disturbances, cognitive dysfunction, and immunological suppression. We probably should talk about individualized therapy again for fibromyalgia patients rather than one size fits all. By the way, this was described in Arthritis and Rheumatism, Volume 48, page 2916 in 2003. Does dietary modification play any role in modulating fibromyalgia's symptoms and signs and outcome? And the answer is yes to that. There's a very nice review that appeared in Complementary Health Practice Reviews, Volume 8, page 234 in 2003, on dietary modification. And this had to do with getting rid of dietary excitotoxins like monosodium glutamate, for instance, and the sulfite, and lowered inflammatory potential, improving redox potential by lowering oxidative stress, improving bowel flora, and lowering some of the central nervous system immunological activation through the microglia. Now, that description that Dr. Alan Logan defines for dietary modification of fibromyalgia is the exact approach that we've been discussing from our research over the last 10-plus years. I've described on a number of occasions the really remarkable work that Dr. Scott Rignan has done in this area with chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia patients, putting them through a hepatic resuscitation program to improve gastrointestinal and hepatic detoxification, normalizing their oxidative stress by using balanced levels of redox-active substances like lipoic acid, coenzyme Q10, vitamin E, N-acetyl-carnitine, and then rebuilding membranes using the essential fatty acids of the omega-3 family. And in fact, as you probably know, there's some very nice work that's recently been done in the use of omega-3 fatty acids as an adjunct to therapy for both chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia. This appeared in the Journal of the Nutraceutical Association recently. This is actually a paper that was authored by Dr. Garth Nicholson, who is the Nicholson of the Singer-Nicholson model of the lipid bilayer of membranes, now the model that's discussed and believed around the world as the way to describe the plum pudding model of cellular membranes, where the proteins are embedded within the lipid bilayer and transport substances across the membrane selectively. And he talks about lipid replacement using omega-3 fatty acids as an adjunct to therapy for chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia to help build back mitochondrial, cellular, and cytoplasmic membranes. And we would generally do that after we had reduced the oxidative stress. So you would first intervene with your detoxification program, you then come through with your antioxidant therapies or redox mitochondrial resuscitation program, and then lastly you start rebuilding membranes with your essential fatty acid supplementation, recalling that you don't want to give high levels of omega-3 fatty acids to people that are in extraordinary oxidative stress because of the ease of these fatty acids to be peroxidized and to undergo, quote, biological rancidity. So you generally hold that stage of the therapy after you'd got the fire quelled slightly with regard to the oxidative stress. So this becomes a metabolic basis then for the management of fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue. Actually, this is discussed in a very interesting review paper recently in Medical Hypothesis, volume 61, page 182 in 2003, looking at this metabolic basis for fibromyalgia management based upon this model of neuroendocrine immune balancing. Well, that will take us very nicely into our discussion with our clinician of the month as to how we look at an endocrinologically disturbed woman who has obstetrical problems, gynecological problems, from a holistic functional medicine perspective. And there's no one better than I know to communicate this message than our clinician of the month. Once again, we're at that look forward to portion of our functional medicine update. That's our clinician of the month. As you know, we've had a theme for the last several months as it pertains to hormone metabolism, hormone balance, particularly focusing on estrogen, progesterone, and androgens. I thought it would be very useful to follow up some of the research discussions that we've had over the last several months with news to use from a clinician who is at the forefront of this field and is really dealing with these problems on a daily basis with his patients, and that's Dr. Alan Warshawski, who is a obstetrician-gynecologist, graduate of Downstate Medical Center at SUNY, has worked extensively over the last 30 years in the area of obstetrics gynecology, with the last decade or so really focusing on what you might call integrated or complementary care, bringing the best of the best to look at how to manage complex patient problems in this area of women's health-related issues. And, of course, there's no time that's probably more interesting to think, collaborate, and to work on this than right now with the Women's Health Initiative and some of the new things that have come out as it relates to our preconceived thoughts about the value of Premarin, which now seem to be changed considerably with new data. So it's with great enthusiasm and expectation that I'd like to welcome Dr. Warshawski to Functional Medicine Update. And as you probably know, he plays not only a role in his private practice in managing these issues of women's health-related problems, but also as a part of his contributions to the Women's Health Program at Beth Israel's Continuum Center in New York City, where he's the director of the Women's Health Program. So, Dr. Warshawski, we welcome you to Functional Medicine Update and are very anxious to get from the horse's mouth what's going on in this field and where some of the answers might emerge.
Thanks very much, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be on the show with you and have an opportunity to talk about some of the things that I've been doing over the last decade or so. It's really been a very interesting decade in terms of women's health from the perspective of hormone replacement, hormone balance, a lot of the new information on the catecholestrogen. Just in listening to your program, we could see that over the last several years, there's been a lot of new information, a lot of controversy, and a lot of new questions. Every time we seem to learn something, it seems to open up an entire avenue of exploration. I've been working with a holistic approach or an integrative approach to women's health now for about 15 to 20 years, perhaps even longer, because when I started in medicine, I was dealing with the issues of premenstrual syndrome, and it wasn't even regarded as a true clinical entity, but I found that women were really suffering. And back in the mid-70s, found that if you just supplemented a few vitamins and cleaned up the diet and actually listened to these people, giving a body-mind therapeutic effect, these people were starting to improve. Soon after that, I found that women were not dealing well with the one-size-fits-all therapy of menopause using Premarin and Provera. There were many, many symptoms, negative symptoms, side effects related to the Premarin. And I found that by using bioidentical hormones, hormones that were identical to what the human ovary was producing, and individualizing care, I found that I was getting better results, less negative effects, and better therapeutic effects, alleviation of symptoms. In continuing to evaluate and continuing to develop my own therapeutic programs, I started dealing with issues of hormone imbalance in the reproductive years, fibroid tumors of the uterus being a major issue. I was really concerned around those years about unnecessary hysterectomies and unnecessary surgeries. Doing a lot of surgery myself at that time, I was noticing that normal-sized uteruses were being removed for conditions such as bleeding, and I knew at that time that if I was doing more of an integrative or functional approach, I could alleviate those symptoms, and the need for surgery was certainly diminished. So I put together programs from an integrative or functional approach that would alleviate a lot of these symptoms. And I started finding that I could no longer just deal with a uterus or an ovary in terms of helping to alleviate some of the common symptoms and common conditions associated with fibroids or PMS or polycystic ovaries. I started looking at some of the other issues, such as gastrointestinal problems or detoxification issues, inflammatory issues, issues of sugar dysregulation, and certainly the hormonal imbalances that weren't just involved with estrogen and progesterone, but involved adrenal hormones and thyroid hormones and the hypothalamic pituitary axis. Issues such as emotional states were also important because they seem to be affecting hormone imbalance. And in looking at the limbic system, which is affecting the hypothalamus pituitary axis, we can see that there's an emotional component that would affect hormonal balance. instead of just looking at estrogens and progesterone and conditions associated with the uterus and ovaries, my focus became a total body focus in looking at gastrointestinal dysbiosis states or permeability problems, yeast and bacterial overgrowth, parasites, all seemed to be affecting how hormones were in balance or in imbalance. Liver detoxification and other detoxification systems in the body also came into effect, because if the GI tract was not functioning adequately, then this was putting an additional burden on the detoxification capabilities of the body, and because of that, this was putting hormones in a state of imbalance. So it wasn't just giving hormones or working with hormones in a replacement sense, it was working with detoxification issues and working with the GI issues before we could even affect the hormone imbalance. And then we started looking at issues such as sugar dysregulation and insulin levels, and we found that certainly in polycystic ovary conditions, and now I'm finding in other conditions of hormone imbalance, whether it's fibroid tumors or functional ovarian cysts, that there's a major piece of this that's related to sugar dysregulation and insulin resistance, and then that will in turn affect estrogen progesterone balance and, more importantly, inflammation in the body. So from this kind of viewpoint, I moved on to look at inflammatory states, because we know that increased insulin levels and sugar dysregulation and deposition of adipose tissue in the body is going to increase inflammatory messenger molecules that will also have a major impact on hormone balance. So from an initial approach of just looking at what's going on in the pelvis as a traditional OBGYN is trained, my approach is really now encompassed the entire body, and including the emotional state of the patient, in trying to put the whole body back into balance rather than just trying to work on a small piece of it without acknowledging all the other issues that are coming into play.
That is a very impressive program. Obviously, it deals with the patient as a unique individual rather than hammering them into some diagnostic criteria and then treating them as if they were a diagnosis. But I would imagine that also increases the complexity of your life, both from a professional perspective and how you integrate all these things together, and also probably from a business perspective, because just the way you've described it implies time, time to ask the right questions, time to have the right communication. How have you gone from that setting that seems to be highly mechanized, the traditional OBGYN setting that is built on efficiency, to this model which is built around relationship and understanding?
I'm glad you really asked that question, because I decided about 4 years ago that I was going to stop doing obstetrics because I couldn't devote the amount of time necessary to do a good obstetrical practice plus to do this kind of an integrative or holistic approach to healthcare. Before that, I had been doing both. I had been setting aside a couple of days a week to just see integrative medicine patients and to devote the amount of time necessary. A new patient would be about an hour and a half. Revisits would be 30 to 45 minutes. So I would devote 2 days a week just for these kinds of patients. But I found that with my obstetrical practice, I'd be canceling my hours very frequently because I'd be up all night. So 4 years ago, I stopped doing obstetrics and devoted myself to this kind of approach to healthcare. At that same time, I also stopped taking all managed care. So I took myself out of that loop completely, where I was dependent upon reimbursements through insurance companies, and I became fee-for-service, and found that it made no difference for the patients who needed this kind of an approach, because they had already been to a half dozen or more different physicians with these chronic complaints, these chronic conditions that there's really no good ICD-9 code for, and there really isn't a good treatment for, because basically treatments are just the medical treatments are treating symptoms, and surgical treatments are removing the tip of the iceberg, the piece of the problem that we can see, but none of this is getting to the why of the problem. Now, to me, the why of the problem are these conditions, and I see six of them that stand out to me, is inflammatory imbalances, what we call the TH1, TH2 imbalances, immunological issues, hormone imbalance, gastrointestinal detoxification issues, and certainly the sugar dysregulation issues. So the conventional approach wasn't looking at any of these whys. To look at these whys, you really need the time, and to have the time, especially in Manhattan, you need to be able to pay your bills and pay your monthly overhead charges. So getting out of managed care was really very helpful. And I have found over the last few years that I don't need to do surgery any longer. Most of the surgical procedures that I was doing, I no longer have to do because of this particular approach. And the cases that do need to be done, there's always somebody around that will be very happy to do the surgery, and then the patient will come back because the patient still wants this kind of a care for their chronic issues. That was the direction that I decided to go in, and I've been very, very happy with it because even though I've kind of changed my identity, and it's at my stage of life, I've been in practice over 25 years, never thinking that I would be in a position now where I'm moving on completely to another field of medicine, but it's been very fruitful and very satisfying because patients with these chronic conditions that there is no good conventional therapy for are getting better. And when I say to myself, what have I done? I've given up my identity. You know, I love doing obstetrics. I've delivered 3 of my 5 children. I enjoy doing surgery. I've given all that up. What have I done? And then a patient will come in and say, thank you, because I've been to a half dozen doctors over the last half dozen years or so, and nothing has improved. And after being on your program for 3 months, my menstruation is normalized. My energy is better. My mood is better. My husband thanks you. So these are the kinds of comments that I get almost on a regular basis that keep me going and show me not only the efficacy of doing this, but the utility of this kind of approach just seems to be phenomenal to me. It amazes me all the time.
I want to add just a parenthetical sidebar. I have a pretty ambitious travel schedule, so I guess the good part of the travel schedule is I get a chance to visit all over the country and check in with different places and frequently get to the New York City area. And I'm a testament to how many people have been your patients, and through interesting and sometimes second-level connections, your name will come up in conversation, and they'll say, oh, boy, yeah, Dr. Warshawski, he was a savior. I've never been treated like his program. It's just an amazing form of medicine. You know, every doctor should be like that. So your reputation obviously precedes you. I hope you're gaining a lot of personal attribution for that, because you certainly are making a big difference.
Oh, thanks very much, Jeff. I appreciate that quite a bit. As I said, sometimes I question, but when I hear things like this and when I hear it from patients especially, it just keeps me going because I know that I'm on the right track. So when I see a patient who has really severe fibroids, for example, I can think of 2 or 3 patients who've come in actually from the hospital after having blood transfusions for their fibroids, and I'll put them on a program certainly evaluating the GI tract, which I find more than 90% of the time is full of bacterial imbalance and yeast overgrowth, very often parasites that haven't been picked up. Doing a gut restoration program and supporting liver detoxification, dealing with their sugar dysregulation issues and the inflammatory states, and putting them on a simple program to begin with, which just may be a stress reduction, a nutritionally rich program, within 3 weeks, most of these people are starting to feel better. And then dealing with the bleeding issues, I do a lot of herbal therapies and other anti-inflammatory therapies. I would say that 80 to 90% of these people within 3 to 4 weeks are incredibly improved in terms of their energy, their state of well-being, their sleep issues seem to get resolved, their skin clears up, they walk in. They're extremely thankful, and then if you follow them over a couple of months, the menses lighten up, the pressure symptoms, the pain symptoms all seem to subside. For the first time in years, they feel like they could get out of their house while they're having their menstrual cycle. They don't have to be confined to the bathroom because they're just hemorrhaging so badly. These are real issues. A majority of women come to me with fibroids who are already scheduled for surgery. They'll come in to me as a kind of third opinion. 2 or 3 doctors, 2 or 3 gynecologists have already recommended total hysterectomies or other invasive surgical procedures as the only way of dealing with their issues. And I would say that 80% or more of them never have surgery. Their conditions, their symptoms seem to clear up to the point where they don't need surgery. They're extremely happy. They're functioning in society again where they weren't. They're able to do their work. And it's extremely gratifying. It takes time, but the results are well worthwhile.
I'd like to jump in and say that your book, Healing Fibroids, A Doctor's Guide to a Natural Cure, which was a Simon & Schuster publication, is an excellent, excellent overview, well worth our listeners getting a hold of, because I think you've really described both what you do and why you do it in a way that's very understandable.
Well, I wanted to get it out to the public because, as you probably know, there are almost 300,000 hysterectomies done in this country every year for fibroids. And I would say that the vast majority of them do not need to be done, that we could deal with the issues of fibroids from a functional approach. Even the American College of OBGYN has come out in their recent practice management bulletin and said that fibroids as benign tumors do not need to be removed surgically unless symptoms necessitate it. So if we could deal with symptoms, it leaves us a lot of time to work with the issues that are causing the fibroids to grow. And I think it's Eleanor Stewart in Boston has been doing a lot of work on growth factors found in fibroid tumors and how these growth factors are influenced by inflammatory states. And I have found that, as I said, over 90% of women with fibroids have some kind of intestinal inflammation issues. So if you consider that the intestines are lying right on these fibroids, right in the pelvic area where estrogens are being produced, and estrogen is a growth hormone, and we have inflammatory messenger molecules that are stimulating cellular change within the myometrium of the uterus, and then the estrogens are causing the fibroids to grow, you need to clear up the inflammatory issues in the gut. I mean, it's almost a no-brainer to me that these are the issues that need to be cleared up, and I've used the 4R program that I thank you so much for. I mean, patients are thrilled, and for the first time in years and years, they don't have the bloat and the other digestive problems associated with their irritable bowel syndrome or inflammatory bowel disease. So clearing these things up and then working on the symptoms of the fibroids themselves, it's really extremely beneficial. Fibroids stop growing. They start shrinking. Other conditions of hormone imbalance similarly improve. Certainly with conditions like polycystic ovaries, which seem to be in the medical news more and more recently because of the connection with insulin. If you can use these PPAR agonists and PPAR modulators and you can get insulin resistance to get diminished and you can reduce your insulin levels and increase sugar utilization, a lot of these inflammatory issues seem to clear up also. And you could clear up polycystic ovary conditions and all the associated problems with it, whether it's cardiovascular disease or type 2 diabetes or all of the other chronic conditions of aging, which are now seem to be associated with inflammatory states. If you can clear up these sugar dysregulation issues, you could reduce the incidence of many of these diseases of aging. So it's not just GYN issues. It's not just reducing surgical procedures in terms of fibroids. What I'm now doing is dealing with all the conditions of aging, from dementias and arthritides and cancers and cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes, which you've called a pandemic. It seems to be all connected with these six major issues that I've just mentioned. So when I see a patient who's coming in with quote-unquote hormone imbalance that's either represented by fibroids or functional cysts or fibrocystic breast problems or even cervical dysplasia, that to me is just the tip of the iceberg. And the other conditions, the why conditions, why is this happening? Those are the basic conditions, the inflammation, immunological, hormone imbalance, sugar dysregulation, GI and detox issues that need to be cleared up first, so that you can reduce the risks of the diseases of aging in later life. So that's what I've gotten at it, this approach and this kind of journey that I've been on, journeying from the traditional GYN medical school curriculum, which is basically fallopian tubes, ovaries, uterus, and vagina, to a total body approach, and ultimately to increase the optimal health of the individual and reduce this aging process, reduce this degenerative aging process in the same time.
Well, that was absolutely beautiful. You know, that was about a 10-minute summary of what we try to do in the 6-day course called Applied Functional Medicine and Clinical Practice, where doctors come in for a 6-day Institute for Functional Medicine training program. I could never have heard a better summary of what we're trying to achieve by application of those 6 principles that you described. For those listeners who may not be familiar with the acronym 4R, I thought I'd just quickly mention those R's. Those 4R's stand for remove, replace, reinoculate, and repair. That's the gut restoration program. So removing the allergens and the toxins and the parasites and the bacterial overgrowth, and then replacing with digestive enzymes where necessary, and then reinoculate is the pre and probiotics to reinoculate the gut with a friendly bacteria, and lastly the repair nutrients like pantothenic acid, zinc, glutamine, and vitamin E to help to repair gut mucosal integrity. So just wanted to make sure everyone understands when you referred to 4R.
That's something that I started doing about 10 or 15 years ago, and it has been one of the mainstays of therapeutic treatment for these chronic conditions. Yeah, I thank you so much for that.
Thank you. And I'd like to go back to pick up something you said early on. As we all know, we lost a great pioneer, a great leader in our field with the passing of Dr. John Lee recently. Maybe for our listeners, you can tell us a little bit about your experience with bioidentical progesterone and where you think it fits into this puzzle.
Well, I think that progesterone gets depleted a number of different ways in our society. Certainly, I think that there's enough stress in our society with the concomitant elevations in cortisol and alterations in DHEA and progesterone that I think increase progesterone deficiency states in the reproductive years. I suspect there are numerous nutritional deficiencies that also play a role. It's been estimated that over 70% of the population doesn't even achieve the RDA of things like magnesium and zinc, both extremely important minerals for hormone balance. And B vitamins also get depleted very easily in the stressful situations, B6 in particular. I have found low levels in some of the testing that I've done. So progesterone, I think, is a very sensitive marker of stress. Certainly stress also has a major impact on ovulation, and we know that when women don't ovulate, they don't make any progesterone in the ovaries, and then my feeling is that whatever progesterone is being produced elsewhere, as in the adrenals, is really going more towards production of stress hormones like cortisol. So low progesterone levels or abnormal estrogen-progesterone ratios, I think, are extremely common in many of the conditions that I see. Replacing or restoring the normal ratio between estrogen and progesterone becomes extremely important. Natural progesterone transdermal creams work very, very well to restore that ratio. It's certainly not the only thing that we do, but in somebody who is symptomatic premenstrually, symptomatic with symptoms of excess estrogens, natural progesterone could be extremely helpful in that regard. I also use the 3% progesterone cream that was promoted by John Lee in menopausal issues. So in menopause, I use bioidentical or hormones that are identical to what the human ovary makes. In addition to the estrogens, I also use natural progesterone. Now, the conventional thinking is that once a woman has a hysterectomy, has her uterus removed, she can just use estrogens and doesn't need a progesterone to balance it out in the uterus because there's not going to be any uterine cancer. What I don't understand is where is the thinking that there are estrogen and progesterone receptors in other parts of the body, in the brain, in bone, in heart, in blood vessels. So if we're giving estrogens and we're not replacing it with progesterones, we're going to be stimulating more of an imbalance. So in those cases, I also like to use the 3% progesterone creams. It's been suggested that the transdermal progesterone creams don't get into the body. My understanding of that is that when conventional progesterone levels are done, serum levels, they throw away the red cells, but the red blood cells are, in effect, carrying the progesterone. So they're basically throwing away evidence that the progesterone is being absorbed transdermally, and we could increase the belief that progesterone is being absorbed by doing saliva testing. So saliva testing for progesterone will show that progesterone is being absorbed transdermally. So I think the transdermal progesterones are very effective. They're certainly absorbed and can be very helpful in a complete program in restoring estrogen-progesterone balance. some of the work by Dr. Lee on osteoporosis treatment using the 3% progesterone creams has not been borne out in subsequent studies. I do think it's certainly helpful in a total approach, but not by itself. And other interesting work done by Helene Leonetti actually showed that using the 3% progesterone cream in women with a uterus menopausally would protect the uterus using a 0.625 Premarin. So we know there's a lot of efficacy in using the 3% creams and can be very helpful as part of a total program.
Could I go on to another controversial area, and I know you certainly have some both experience and opinion, and that's the modulation of estrogen-related symptomatologies with soy isoflavones. There's kind of a backlash recently against soy for fear that it's going to stimulate estrogen receptors and cause problems. What's your experience and position on this question?
Well, my experience has been using levels of soy that approach what's been found in the Asian diet, someplace between 30 to 100 milligrams of the isoflavones per day, has a modulatory effect on estrogen levels. So if estradiol has a strength of 1 in terms of its estrogenic effects, soy would have a much lower estrogenic effect, maybe 1 to 1 500th to 1 1000th. So soy is acting more as a tonic. If estrogen levels are very high and you add some soy to the mixture, the soy is going to compete with the stronger estrogens for the receptor sites. That's going to bring down the total estrogen effect. If the estrogen levels are low, as they can be in menopause, adding the soy isoflavones will help fill up some of these receptor sites that would have been empty, and that would kind of raise the estrogen effect. As with anything else, you could overdo it, and you could take very, very large levels of isoflavones and perhaps get into trouble that way, maybe with thyroid conditions. But my feeling is that using soy in moderation only acts as a modulator of estrogen in the body or a tonic of estrogen in the body and is not harmful. There was a meta-analysis of about 300 different soy studies done by Dr. Messina in Philadelphia. And after evaluating over 300 studies, his take was that soy in moderation is not harmful and is probably helpful and would not be contraindicated even in women who are breast cancer survivors. If we're talking about soy isoflavones as potentially dangerous, then we have to look at some of the other foods that have isoflavones in them also. I mean, there are fruits like apples and pomegranates and several other fruits that have fairly high levels of isoflavones in them. So, you know, are we going to restrict all those things from the diet also? And it doesn't really make that much sense to me. I am a proponent of using soy in beneficial amounts, and that's being about what approximating the Asian diet. I use other modulators of estrogens from foods also. I think flax seeds are extremely important for modulating estrogen levels, and they also have their own isoflavones, and using flax seeds and soy in combination, which I often do with some of the soy protein powders, seems to be very helpful in reducing some of the symptoms of menopause. So many of my patients are businesswomen in Manhattan. They don't have time to even have breakfast. They run out of the house, thereby beginning the insulin resistance picture. And I have them use a soy protein powder shake first thing in the morning using soy, getting about 20 milligrams of the isoflavones from the soy and using flax seeds along with that and adding some extra fiber. And most of my patients love it and feel great. It gives them energy for a good part of the day and alleviates a lot of their symptoms. So I'm a major proponent of using soy in a moderate amounts.
Can I ask one other nutritional modulator, and that's crucifers. A lot of people have had different opinions about whether the glucosinolates found in cruciferous vegetables and their secondary metabolites like indole-3-carbinol and dienoylmethane are in fact beneficial or not for modulating hormones. What's your experience?
Well, I've certainly used the indole-3-carbinol and dienoylmethane for women who have hormone imbalances. I do measure the 2:16 ratio, although right now I'm not exactly sure where we're going with that. I do feel that you need to have good levels of the 2-hydroxyestrones in comparison to the 16s. My feeling has also been that there is an inverse relationship between the 4-hydroxycatecholestrogens and the 2-catecholestrogens, and so you want to keep the 2-catecholestrogens a little bit higher compared to the 16 catechols. I would be happy when the day comes when we can measure the fours or we can measure the effects of the four catechols on DNA. But I have certainly found that in women using combinations of indole-3-carbinol and DIM seems to increase the 2-hydroxyestrones. I believe that the crucifers are extremely important for liver detoxification. I have a very quick personal story. When I was an intern, I came down with serum hepatitis and for some reason couldn't eat anything. My weight dropped from about 170 to 139. I was just ready to get hospitalized. And then for some reason I started eating Brussels sprouts. I hadn't eaten Brussels sprouts before. I think there was a frozen package in the freezer. And I started eating Brussels sprouts twice a day. Within a short period of time, my enzymes started coming down, my weight started coming back up, and since that time, which is now almost 30 years ago, Brussels sprouts is my favorite vegetable. As a major crucifer and food that has a lot of these glucosinolates in it and affects liver detoxification, I think that crucifers should be an important part of everybody's diet, and I certainly recommend 1 to 2 servings for everybody every day.
Well, I want to commend you because as much as I would love to eat more Brussels sprouts, they're just not somehow on my palatability scale. But I did see a very interesting paper published just within the last month, authored by Dr. Elizabeth Jeffrey and her group at the University of Illinois, looking at Brussels sprouts and the influence they have directly on glutathione as transferase and detoxifying phase 2 enzyme systems in hepatic cells, and found that the broccoli extracts protect against oxidative injury and upregulate phase 2 detoxification. This is actually published in the most recent Journal of Nutraceuticals and Functional Medical Foods, Volume 4, page 5 and 203. And I think that people who increase those cruciferous vegetables, if they're not a Brussels sprout lover, then they got the broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage secondary opportunities, there really are positive benefits that can be realized. And in fact, you can measure, as you say, the alteration in their 2 to 16 hydroxylated estrogen ratios when they get on these increased crucifer-rich diets.
Yeah, and if I had to pick one thing that works the best or that has the most impact, I would say it's dietary change. So getting the hormones out of the diet, removing the commercial sources of poultry and meats, getting the acidic foods out of the diet, so again, poultry, meats, dairy products, that helps to reduce inflammation. And I also see gluten grains, you know, the wheat and the rye and the barley, these high gluten levels also seem to have a tremendous impact on increasing hormone imbalance, thyroid imbalance, immunological and inflammatory imbalances. I started doing celiac panels on anybody who comes in with a hormone problem, and I have found almost 50% of women have some elevation of the IgG gliadin antibody. You know, I don't think that anybody is doing that regularly, but just getting these people off the gluten grains for 3 to 6 months makes a tremendous impact in their energy and in their sense of well-being and all these hormonal symptoms. So you don't always have to go to a medication or an herb. You don't always have to even use supplements because there are so many people who, for one reason or another, don't like taking supplements. They don't like taking vitamins. But if you can get them to change their diet, remove some of these inflammatory foods, these acidic foods, these allergenic foods, they start feeling better. And if you could just get a foot in the door and show them that any kind of lifestyle change is going to help them to start feeling better, then they can start picking up on some of the other things that need to be done, whether it's gut restoration or supplements for PPAR agonists, whatever it is. If you can get a foot in the door and they see that they're starting to feel better, then they can move on and then they become committed to their own health. And I think that's probably the major thing that I do is that I get people to become committed to self-nurturing. So many of my patients have been nurturers. They nurture everybody else, whether they're businesswomen or housewives. They're nurturers, and they don't nurture themselves. So a major piece of what I do is get people to understand that they can nurture themselves. They're entitled to being nurtured. And just getting them to understand that helps them to become committed to a program where they're going to be optimally healthy.
That's a magnificent message, and I think that must play so wonderfully with your patients because I'm sure that they have not heard that as the standard line from their other physicians. So it really frames a whole different type of medicine, and I guess that's why we've coined the term functional medicine because it sounds like that has a connection of function between the provider, the practitioner, and the patient.
Yeah, one question I always ask is, what is it that gives you joy in life? When I do get a patient who tells me nothing gives me joy in life, that's going to be a difficult patient. Whatever the condition is, when there's nothing that gives them joy in life, that's a real challenge. You need to find something that's going to give them joy in life. And many of these patients, I'll put on Prozac or another antidepressant just so that they can get out of bed and start seeing that there is a rose that they could smell. You know, it's not even stop and smell the roses. They don't even know that there are roses that they can smell because they can't even get out of bed in the morning.
Well, I think we have all learned a tremendous amount from your wisdom that you've shared with us in the last 30 minutes. This has been, I think, what holistic medicine was all designed to be, and that is to really look at the individual as a functioning whole organism in which the sum of the parts are greater than the whole, and to recognize that we're not treating organs, we're treating people. Dr. Warchowski, I want to thank you so much for sharing this with us, and I hope that this can be a stimulus to produce hundreds, if not thousands, of more physicians like you across the country.
Thank you very much, Jeff. I really appreciate it.
The best to you, and we'll talk to you real soon. Happy New Year.
You too, Jeff.
We once again thank Dr. Warchowski for his excellent presentation and almost kaleidoscopic overview of the field of natural management of hormones. And that concludes our February issue for 2004, and we'll look forward to being with you in March next month.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by the Institute for Functional Medicine, located in Gig Harbor, Washington, USA. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.